From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR's correspondents from around the globe. I'm Kevin Beasley. This week, remembering the dead in Iraq, the effect of hurricanes on Haiti, and a profile of Israel's likely new leader. The people of Iraq are living in greater security than they have done in years. But even so, hundreds of people continue to die each month, betraying the talk of calm in Iraq heard in the United States. Some Iraqis who knew the victims of violence there have started to commemorate the dead with billboards that are springing up along the streets of the capital. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports from Baghdad.
Tariq Shakir Hamoudi hasn't heard the relentless commentary echoing across America this election year. He hasn't heard that the U.S. troop surge single-handedly brought calm to Baghdad and that America is within sight of victory in Iraq. He's been too busy relearning how to walk after an explosion last year in this same spot killed his brother and left him with two badly damaged legs. Water drips from a charred and broken pipe across the street from Hamoudi's small roadside shop in Baghdad's Mansour neighborhood. A stocky man in his late 50s, Hamoudi hobbles on two metal canes to approximately where he was standing last Friday night when a suicide bomber rammed his vehicle into a passing convoy belonging to Iraqi politician Ahmed Chalabi.
I fell down inside my shop and I heard my two friends. They were wounded and crying for help. I said, "I can't help you." When I got up, I was going crazy. I saw people lying everywhere.
It was another failed attempt to assassinate Chalabi, the former exile responsible for much of the flawed intelligence used by the Bush administration to press for the invasion of Iraq. The large car bomb tore viciously through the neighborhood, splattering bits of hair and flesh on the roof across the street, where 83-year-old Samira was trying to sleep in the brutal summer heat. Her long gray hair trembling, she says in a querulous voice that things may be better for some Iraqis, but not for her.
The security situation is bad. The explosions are still happening. 2 months ago, a bomb exploded and all my windows were broken. And now this latest explosion has basically destroyed my house.
Viewed from a distance, there is no question that Iraq is a less violent place in 2008 than it has been in years. Figures compiled by Iraq's Interior Ministry show the Iraqi death toll falling from thousands each month in 2006 to hundreds each month this year. In July and August, the totals were just over 100 fatalities per month. As always, the vast majority civilians. But in today's Baghdad, reminders of death are everywhere. Traditionally, Iraqi families hung cloth banners announcing the names of their dead. But lately, billboards have appeared, large and small, complete with names, photos, date of death, and sometimes a phrase from the Quran. Print shop worker Abdul Khalik Al-Araji says the requests for martyrs' billboards come in steadily.
The strangest order I got was a billboard for 18 martyrs, all from the same family. They all died on the same day, a mother, her daughters and sons, in one attack. I guess I should say it's not really strange, but it's a painful thing.
Lately, the billboards have begun to feature not just the newly killed, but some of those who perished in earlier carnage, before the Bush administration committed five additional brigades to Iraq. 35-year-old Ali Hamid knows that some Iraqis are uncomfortable with the billboard featuring his five family members, who died along with more than 100 others in a rocket and car bomb attack that caused buildings to collapse in the Karada neighborhood in late July 2006. He himself doesn't need the billboard to remind him to honor their memory, but he thinks his government absolutely does.
The main reason to put up this billboard is to remind our officials, we voted you into power, and what have we gained? We're still burying our children. We hope our leaders ask themselves, why did this young man die? Why was this little girl killed? They protect themselves in the green zone and leave us to die every day.
For the month of August, a comparatively quiet month, the government reported 92 roadside bombs, 54 mortars, 7 car bombs, a dozen Katyusha rocket attacks, and 7 car bombs, resulting in 462 Iraqis killed or wounded. As September opened in Anbar province, hailed as a model for turning the country around, 4 Iraqi policemen were attacked at a checkpoint outside Fallujah. 2 were kidnapped, and 2 were killed on the spot, their heads lopped off, Al-Qaeda style. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Baghdad.
Haiti is trying to recover after being hit by four storms in the past few weeks, which have left hundreds of people dead and hundreds of thousands homeless or in dire need. Officials say Hurricane Ike alone killed 61 people in Haiti before it headed towards the United States. NPR's Jason Beaubien reports now on the situation in one of Haiti's hardest-hit cities, Gonaïves.
Outside the main prison in Gonaïves, on a street awash with gooey brown mud, a UN peacekeeper is stitching up a woman's foot. The main hospital in Gonaïves and most of the health clinics were destroyed in Tropical Storm Hanna. Captain Manzoor Ahmed from the Pakistani Brigade says it would take too long to send this woman through the floodwaters to the one remaining hospital across town.
It was very necessary. If we don't close here, she may bleed a lot, okay? It was very necessary over here.
He said he had no choice but to deal with the wound immediately. The woman is resting her bloody foot on a T-shirt in the mud. Captain Ahmed is sewing up the wide gash on the top of her foot as a large crowd looks on. Word quickly spread that a doctor was outside the prison, and people started carrying other injured and sick to Captain Ahmed for attention. Inside the prison, inmates are chanting that they don't have anything to eat. When Captain Ahmed isn't performing first aid out on the street, he's one of the Pakistani soldiers assigned to help guard the more than 200 inmates in the Gonaïves jail. During Tropical Storm Hanna, the prison flooded and the Pakistanis had to move the prisoners up onto the roof at 3 in the morning. Ahmed says it's true that the inmates don't have any food.
Right now they haven't got any food because, you know, the vehicle which was bringing water and food, I have already explained, it is stuck up on the way. You might have seen. Whenever we will get it out, definitely we will be giving them the food. But that food is not enough. Even we are facing shortage of food and water because of these environments.
To help the aid effort, the U.S. Navy has sent the USS Kearsarge, which carries 8 helicopters. The massive choppers are capable of moving heavy cargo from ships into Gonaïves. This is hugely important because Hurricane Ike knocked out the last road connecting Gonaïves to the capital, Port-au-Prince. The only problem at the moment is there's nowhere for them to land. Eric Mouifarin is the top UN humanitarian official here. He says currently the only landing pad they have is on the UN base, and it's already overly congested.
We made an assessment this morning. We tried to look for the soccer field and other places. We are absolutely flooded. There's no way, nowhere we can land at the moment unless we find a new zone, which we are looking for.
The USS Kearsarge also has 3 amphibious landing craft, which will be used initially to move relief supplies from the main vessel onto shore. And people here are desperate for assistance. The Catholic Cathedral of Gonaïves is inundated with mud. The pews are strewn in every direction as if the devil himself had come in and furiously kicked the chairs about. Roughly 50 people have been living in the back upper balcony of the cathedral for more than a week. 34-year-old Avalom Latortue says he's still alive by the grace of God.
He said, yes, he had faith in God. While he was in the rain, while it was raining so hard and the wind was blowing, he was praying that God will calm the water, calm the rain, so that he would be able to make it somewhere with his kids.
But not all of his children made it. One of his 4 daughters, he says, 13-year-old Wadaline, was washed away in the current. He says Tropical Storm Hanna destroyed his house, and now he'll stay here in the church until he can get help from the government or someone to rebuild. Jason Beaubien, NPR News, Gonaïves, Haiti.
Coming up, the woman likely to be Israel's new prime minister.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new MDX with super-handling all-wheel drive. More information is available at Acura.com.
This is Foreign Dispatch. I'm Kevin Beasley. The Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert says he'll resign later this month as soon as his party selects a new leader. Olmert is stepping down amid allegations of corruption, which he denies. Tzipi Livni, the hard-driving yet soft-spoken foreign minister, looks likely to take over the leadership of the ruling Kadima party and replace Olmert as Israel's prime minister. NPR's Eric Westervelt has this profile.
In some ways, Sippy Livni's life has been shaped by contrasts. She grew up in freewheeling, left-leaning Tel Aviv, yet her parents were heroes of the right-wing Irgun, militant pre-state Jewish guerrillas who used what could be described as terrorist tactics to try to force the British out of Palestine. Her father raised Livni to believe that all of British Mandate Palestine should be the Jewish homeland. She grew up on that dream of holding on to the West Bank land Israel captured in the 1967 war. In 1996, Livni gave up a successful legal career and became active in government as part of the conservative Likud Party. She was elected to parliament in 1999. But 6 years later, she would follow then Prime Minister Ariel Sharon in breaking from Likud to form the more centrist Kadima Party, whose platform calls for territorial compromise with the Palestinians. It marked a break with her family's dreams. Dita Kol Roman, a close friend of hers, says Livni realized Israel could not maintain its Jewish majority and identity if it clings to all of the West Bank.
She said, though for me the greater Israel is the dream, I have to give up that dream because it is more important for me to have a democratic state. Therefore, I want to have a national Jewish home in Israel, and I know that I have to create the same thing for the Palestinian people.
Livni has led the Israeli negotiating team in the U.S.-backed talks with the Palestinians, talks that have so far shown little tangible progress. Right-wing critics here say Livni lacks experience for the prime minister's job and is soft on national security. The Israeli left has criticized Livni for doing nothing to dismantle illegal Jewish outposts in the West Bank or to halt expansion of the larger settlements. In the Kadima Party's primary next week, Livni faces retired General Shaul Mofaz, who's made national security and tough talk against Iran centerpieces of his campaign. If Livni wins the primary, polls show her with a narrow lead, she'll be tasked with forming a new governing coalition to take over from Prime Minister Ehud Olmert, who faces numerous corruption allegations. Livni, in contrast to Olmert, has a sparkling, clean image. Yaron Izrahi of Hebrew University says if Livni wants to be more than merely a transitional political figure, she has to offer more than clean government. She must, he says, do more than talk about disentangling Israel from its 41-year-old occupation of the West Bank.
The challenge that she faces is also the challenge of Israel. If she makes it, she will have to be a different Tzipi Livni, more forceful to overcome the taboos which have been institutionalized by former governments of not removing settlements.
Many Israelis see Livni's public persona as stern, closed, and seemingly humorless. People here took note when Livni actually smiled and laughed during a recent TV interview. Some who've worked in government with Livni describe her as focused and intense, bordering on cold. One colleague who asked not to be named said, "She won't ask you how your weekend was. She'll ask you to get to work." Friends, by contrast, describe her as witty and entertaining, a vegetarian who enjoys jogging and playing the drums.
She's very different in private and person. Fun to be with, very funny, has a great sense of humor.
Dita Kol Roman says the difference between the public and private Livni reflects the reality that she's a woman fighting for acceptance from macho former military men who continue to play a major role in Israeli politics. Livni, she says, wants to change the political culture and its language.
Some of it is the old boys' language. Ex-generals who have a certain language between themselves and certain assumptions about what she knows and what she can or cannot do. I think sometimes it's used against her. She's stern. She has to be very careful.
Critics say she's sometimes too careful. A friend says Livni likes to read mystery novels, but always starts at the end. She likes to know how it ends and then works her way through it. Colleagues say Livni tries to take the same cautious approach to politics and negotiations. Eric Westervelt, NPR News, Jerusalem.
For more international coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Kevin Beasley.